The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Preparing the Ruins, the 2015 Annual Conference Recordings, copyright 2015. If you have purchased this recording, you may make additional copies for use by your school. You may not sell copies of the recording, nor post it on the Internet. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at www.accsedu.org.
And since I like to talk a lot, we should probably get started. So, thank you for joining me in this interaction and joining all of us together. It's an honor. If you look at some of the names of people who are here, it's incredible, so it feels very out of place for me, actually. So before I begin, I'd like to take a quick survey. How many of you in the room are administrators? Okay, good. How many of you are faculty members? Okay, and any parents? And faculty, I guess that could be any of the above, right? Okay, how many just parents, the lone individual parents? No, okay. Well, I'd like to begin by telling you a quick story, and then we'll move into a prayer after that. So, the class, the Comparative Civilizations class, had just reached the end of its unit on Islam, and it was now time for their oral exam. In this imagined exam, I took the personality of an 18-year-old Muslim who grew up in the Sunni tradition from Iran. I had recently moved to the United States with my parents for college. I had the Hadith almost completely memorized, and I was also quite familiar with the Quran. In fact, as an 18-year-old, I was far more familiar with the Quran than most 18-year-old Christian males are with the Bible, to put that in context. So after living in the United States for a few years, I had run across a website about Muslims who had converted to Christianity because the resurrected Jesus Christ had appeared to them. I was curious. What's going on here? I wanted to know about this Jesus, the Jesus of Christianity. So as a curious 18-year-old male, Muslim, I decided to go to the local Barnes Noble and buy an ESV translation of the Bible. Okay, and I also decided to spend the next few weeks at the Starbucks down the street reading the New Testament to get to know this Jesus from Christianity. So while I was at Starbucks one morning, a Christian student approached me as I was reading the Gospel of John. He looked at me and asked, "Are you enjoying the reading?" I put it down and I looked at him and said, "I'm actually quite confused." He pulled up a chair, sat down, looked me in the eye, and said, "Why? Why?" So, for this oral exam, my comparative civilization students had to become this particular Christian student from the imagined scenario I just gave you. And they had to continue the conversation from where we just left off. And that conversation would center on the person, the work, and the life of Jesus Christ. But it could also drift into any other topic that we touched on the unit. However, in this exam, I was not going to assess their ability to retain information or their ability to comprehend ideas. They had to get that done before the assessment took place. Rather, I decided to assess how well, in this imagined scenario, these students demonstrated the seven virtues, or how well they clothed themselves with the fruits of the Spirit. Okay. So, sitting at my desk in preparation to give the first oral exam, I heard a soft knock on my classroom door. I looked out. It was one of my students. He was ready to take this particular exam. He walked in, sat down in front of me, and said, "Mr. Tucker, before we begin, There's something I want to say to you. I was like, okay, what do you have to say? He said, thank you. Now, I actually had just been quite frank with his student about a different topic, and so I was kind of confused why he was thanking me for something. So, in a confused way, I asked, why are you why are you thankful? What are you thankful for? He said this. He said, I haven't enjoyed preparing for an exam in a very, very long time. But for this one, I did. He said, with this format, this oral exam format, since you are taking time out of your day to sit down face to face, to look me in the eye, to hear what I have to say, to know how I feel, to get to know me as a person, right? I realize that you care for me. And because you care for me, he said, I was able to do this assignment with joy, and I was motivated to learn from a heart filled with joy. And because of that, I didn't have to deal with the fear of getting a good grade or the pressure of succeeding in this high-pressured context of the academic world. And he said, because I studied with joy, I actually was able to open myself up to experience truth in a real way. So please pray with me. Dear Father, we all need you so much. We need your grace, your mercy, your love, and your correction every single day. And I pray that you teach all of us to be grateful for all that you have done, to look at your Son with so much awe that we want to fall on our feet or fall on our knees. I pray that in this situation, all that's done is that you receive glory. In your Son's name, amen. So, how many of you have specific intellectual hobbies that you guys can raise your hand? Who has a unique intellectual hobby that they like to do? Does anyone have one? Reading a particular book or studying one particular person? What would you like to share? What is it? You're trying to... Oh, okay. That would be tough. It was... Yeah, that's not easy. Anything else? Anything else? Yeah, go ahead. That brings me back to when I took a biological neurology course when I was in school, and it's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. Any others? Yeah, go ahead. Genealogy. Yeah, I actually, so to share an interesting personal story, I was raised by a single mother, and I've never met my dad. So a few years ago, my mom and I did a study of him and traced all of the lineage back, and it was the first time that I got to know that side of my family, which is kind of me. So any other intellectual hobbies that you guys have? Yeah. Not his books, but C.S. Lewis. Okay. Me too. Okay. Well, one of mine is to use the Apostle Paul's epistles to get to know his psychology. Okay. I like to get inside his head. I like to know him as a person through, of course, his writing, so that I can better understand what lies behind his words, behind his teachings, right? The intent behind all that he's told us and shared with us. So like Paul, every single communicator, right, has undisclosed reasons why their message should be heard or listened to or read. So I'm just going to tell you mine right off the beginning, right? Just lay it all out there. This is what I'd like you to take away. This is what I hope happens right here. So first, I want to try to persuade all of you that humanities classes should adopt oral exams as the primary form of assessment. Okay? Second, I want to try to persuade you that oral assessment is infinitely superior to non-oral assessment methods at accomplishing the purpose of classical Christian education. Okay, and we will get to this purpose momentarily. The third point is that I want to persuade you that oral assessment properly takes into account that our students are fundamentally creatures that love. Okay, we'll talk about the nature of human beings as well. And lastly, the fourth one, which is actually kind of a secondary reason, but I think it just helps everything overall, is that I want to try to persuade you that oral exams were the primary, perhaps the only, assessment format in the classical world. So those are what I hope to do today. And now you know, so there's no dancing around. So now before I begin to try to persuade you of those propositions, there are two essential topics that we need to deal with right at the beginning. And the first one we already discussed, the purpose of classical education. Kind of have to deal with that right at the outset, right? And the second one is the purpose of classical Christian assessment, okay? Which, as we know, must align with the purpose of classical Christian education. So if we do not deal with these, everything that falls will be bumpy and rough, and that just would not be good. So does anyone here have a clear and precise definition of the purpose of classical Christian education? And would anyone like to share that? Yeah, go ahead. Thank you. How many of you agree? Did everyone hear that? Okay, so to cultivate virtue, correct, and for you to appreciate that which is true, good, and beautiful. Okay, how many of you agree with that? Kind of, maybe. Okay, anyone else have another definition for the purpose of classical Christian education? Okay, so I'll share the definition that I'll be working from today with you. The purpose of classical Christian education, and I totally agree with you, is to cultivate virtue in students and to help them reorder what they love, to reorder their loves, to follow Augustine and Jonathan Edwards in that way. So I think this purpose of education is clearly seen in Plato, who shows us that education is about turning the soul. I just think of this hierarchy of being, right? And I think of a person just kind of like launching their soul up to be abducted into the forms of the eternal things and be brought up and transformed by that. But turning the soul to the real, the true, and the good. I think it's evident in Aristotle, who shows us that education is about becoming thoroughly virtuous. A state of being, right? Virtue is a state of being. It reaches through the whole person. It's pervasive. Which for him was the highest goal or the supreme happiness of man. And I believe that when he uses that term happiness, he refers more to an existential joy, right? This deep, fulfilling joy that he has. I even think that we can see it in Seneca, who shows us that education is about liberating the soul through the acquisition of wisdom, ripping off falsehoods and untruths so that the soul can be free. That's what Seneca teaches us. And in Augustine, who shows us that education is about happiness, is about obtaining happiness, and that's existential joy, through the reordering of loves. And the list just continues throughout the classical age. So, if this is the real purpose of education, what is the real purpose of classical Christian assessment? Does anyone have a clear and precise definition of that one? We want to try that one. Yeah, go ahead. Awesome. I like that. Anyone else? Sorry, can you, what did you say again? To observe the virtues that the students possess and to see what they love. Correct. That's what she said. That's good. That's really good. Anyone else have another one that they'd like to offer? We should have had everyone get comfortable, like right here. We could all fit in this section, couldn't we? We got to know each other really well as classical educators. Anyone else have another definition? Yeah. Okay. Okay. Mm-hmm. Good. Did everyone hear that? Okay. Can you say that one more time? You just see whether or not the student is learning what you want them to learn. And then to assess whether or not they're learning. Okay. Okay. Good, thank you. So here are my thoughts on the matter, and by no means are they definitive. If the purpose of classical Christian education is to cultivate virtue in our students and help them reorder their loves, then the purpose of classical Christian assessment must be to evaluate whether or not virtue is being cultivated in our students and whether or not their loves are being properly reordered. So it's very similar to what you said. Yeah. And I actually think that if we are not assessing these, then we are leading our students away from the goal of classical Christian education. In fact, if we are not assessing these, then we are sawing off the very branch we are sitting on, I believe. We are defeating the very purpose we set out to accomplish. So why is this? Well, we'll get into that. So, to answer this why question, we first need to discuss how to identify and how to annihilate the lingering post, I'm just going to use this term because does anyone know who Andrew Curran is? He uses this term, post-class. So we need to first identify and annihilate the lingering post-classical practices that we have made essential components of our classroom. Okay. And yes, we all have those parasitical components still in our classrooms, which is just sad. So on the outline, I have labeled these our gadflies. Okay. So what post-classical practices are still present in our classroom that need to be smashed? I'm going to say that, just smash, crush, smack a fly, in order for us to do assessment well and classically. So the first gadfly that I think that we need to smash is that retention of information and the comprehension of ideas are the primary objects of assessment. Okay, I'm going to say that one more time with a little bit more clarity this time. So assessment should not evaluate as the primary object retention of information or the comprehension of ideas. Rather, they should be placed or understood as necessary preparation for the assessment itself. The student should have those facts already memorized, or they should already have the ideas. They should already have comprehended the ideas before they come to the assessment itself, so that we can re-aim the assessment as something other than those things. And we'll come back to this in a little bit. So why is this? Assessment tells our students what is important. Assessment tells our students what is significant. It tells them what they ought to love. Indeed, I think it modifies their behavior. Right? It modifies what they do. It shapes their souls, and it reconstitutes what they love. So when assessment tells our students to devote their hearts to knowing facts and thinking critically, which are two very good things, okay, we are indirectly telling them that the height of education is factual recollection and critical thinking. Okay. We teach them to forget about character formation, to forget about the cultivation of virtue, and to forget about reconstituting their loves. We teach them to do what they can to recollect a few arbitrary facts, right? Or we're going to have them memorize 5 of the 7 kings of Rome, or 7, or 3. We kind of make the decision on our own, right? They kind of are arbitrary in one sense. They're all important, but when we make the decision, it is somewhat arbitrary. Okay? We teach them that it is acceptable to separate character formation from education when we do that. We teach them that education is not supposed to shape and nurture their souls. And in the end, I think we tell them that education is only about the mind when we do that. So the second gadfly that I think we need to smash, and this is hard for me because I feel like I'm going out on a limb here, but I hope a lot of you agree with me. The second data point that needs to be smashed is that a letter or a number can accurately indicate the state of a student's soul or properly evaluate a student's developmental movement through the process of acquiring virtue or reordering their loves. Okay. Assessments, in my mind, that use letters or numbers have the same negative effect that the first gadfly has on our students. But I would say to an even greater and more dangerous degree. When we slap numbers or letters on our students' work, we are further removing them from the purpose of classical Christian education by telling them to seek the A or the 100% at all costs. We tell them instead that receiving an A or 100% is the purpose of education. And even if we tell them that it's not, the looming presence of the 100% or the A certainly tells them it is. And this, I am convinced, moves them to adopt a pragmatic ethic, in my mind. Where character, where virtue, where loves are meaningless if they do not result in a student getting an A or 100%. That becomes the end and the means. Who cares? So, letters and numbers are actually in conflict with our purpose as classical Christian educators. So, to support this claim a little bit, I'll do a brief survey of when the ABCD model kind of emerged in Western civilization and when that took place. Does anyone know when the first somewhat modern scale or method or system came about in Western civilization and where that happened? Prussia? How about in the U.S.? How about in the U.S.? Yeah. You're getting real close. Holyoke. Holyoke. Good. Yeah, so I'll start a little bit before that and we'll come back because you're absolutely right. So, in the late 18th century, the president of Yale used a four-category assessment system to evaluate his students. Then, a little bit later, in the early 19th century, William and Mary used a class ranking system, which also used that category or that assessment method. I'm not going to get into the details of how they did that or what terms were used or whatnot. But that then led to, as she pointed out, Mount Holyoke College in 1897 using the A, B, C, D, and E model that we use, right? Well, that eventually became an F. But, so, I'm not too trained in the history of assessment, but what I do know is that if this model emerged at this time, there are two very important things we can take away from this. The first one is quite simple. It's not classical. If it's the late 18th century, that's not necessarily classical. And the second is that the classical world must have then used a different method altogether. And so we'll get back to that. So the third gadfly that needs to be smashed, which is closely related to the second, is that letters or numbers can positively motivate character formation. The key there is positively motivate. I definitely think it can motivate character formation. And I do think in certain circumstances it can motivate positive character formation. But in general, it doesn't. In general, it doesn't. And I think this is clearly displayed in our scriptures. Right? We learn that the law, or as Paul says in the New Testament, interestingly enough, the letter of the law, does not produce godly character. But it actually reveals a need, right? A need that we have. It reveals to us that we should desire something, particularly a person, right? Later on, we learn that. The letter of the law left God's people longing for the real presence, right? The real physical presence of the promised Messiah. They wanted to be with him. The law was good, in my mind. but it would be better to be with the Messiah, right? So how did God deal with this? Well, he sent the great teacher into the world to be with his people. And that great teacher put his spirit within us. So God is personally present with us through the indwelling of the Spirit, and it is through that personal presence with us that we are recreated. Thus, in my opinion, when the letter of the law is the relational link between teacher and student, the student is left wanting. The student is left longing to be with us, their teachers, right? The student is left with a desire for something more. So how do we combat this? The classical tradition gives, I think, an unambiguous answer to this. And that is the mentorship or the apprenticeship model, right? The classicists knew that true education has to take place in the context of mentorship or apprenticeship, not in an impersonal context, but a personal one. So now, with those gadflies listed, I would like to show how oral examination not only smashes them, but how it actually revives the assessment process altogether and, in my mind, better harmonizes with the purpose of classical Christian education. So, before we move on, because now we're going to start getting into more of the practical illustration aspect of this, but before moving on, I need to ask all of you to erase your preconceptions about oral exams. This is not because you have done anything, but because I do something when I try to work through constructing a good oral exam. And what I do is I impose those modern or post-classical assessment methods on the oral exam itself, kind of rob it of its power. So let's just start new. Blank slates right now. So, earlier, I contended that assessment should not evaluate retention or retention of information or the comprehension of ideas because they belong in the category of assessment preparation. Right? The students should have them before they come. I also contended at this time that assessment teaches our students what they should love. Right? Assessment aims the heart, and it shapes what it loves. So when assessment tells our students to devote their hearts to knowing facts and thinking about specific ideas, we are indirectly telling them that the height of education is factual recollection and critical thinking. Right? We inadvertently tell them that education is all about the mind, and that it is only concerned with thinking about the good, the true, and the beautiful. So, oral assessment gives us the opportunity to construct an exam that not only involves the mind and thinking, but that also incorporates the whole person. It allows us to reimagine our students' experience. This is key, reimagine the experience that our students have when they take an exam. Okay, so for a second, let's just ponder what our students usually go through when they take an exam. Is it a cold desk? A hard pencil or pen? Flat piece of paper that's usually black and white? Those are joyful colors. Enforced silence, right? They can't speak with anyone. Required isolation. They are the only person allowed to participate in completing the task that we've set before them. And mandated motionlessness. They can't move. They can't do anything, right? They have to sit, rigid and stiff, leaning forward with their heads down so they do not appear to be cheating and so they do not distract others when they're taking this exam. So this experience virtually locks our students in their own head. I just want to point that out. It forces them to only use their minds and to only think about what is before them. This being forced to think about what is before them is really important, in my opinion, because it reveals to us that this particular exam experience this particular exam experience, puts our students outside of an assessment. They do not get to be in the assessment. And it is being in my opinion, an assessment that will reach the whole person. So this distinction is akin to privately reading Shakespeare versus being an actor in the production of Julius Caesar. There's a big difference. There's a big difference. It's akin to reading about a missions trip versus going to Rwanda and loving impoverished children. There is a difference. Right? There is a difference. I think we all have experienced that. So, oral assessment gives us the opportunity to construct an exam that our students get to be in. One that the whole person gets to experience, not just the mind. And since oral assessment lets us reimagine and create the situation itself, and since assessment tells our students what they should love, we can construct an exam or reimagine an exam format that better aims their hearts at what is good, true, and beautiful by putting them in an experience that actually changes them. So point two. Earlier, I also contended that a letter or number cannot accurately indicate the state of a student's soul or properly evaluate a student's developmental movement through the acquisition of virtue or the reordering of their loves. And even further, I contended that a letter or number cannot positively motivate character formation. So if I transform this point into a question, I think it's more powerful. If the purpose of classical Christian education is to cultivate virtue in our students and to help them reorder their loves, then how does a letter or number adequately, or more importantly, justly, inform a student about the state of his soul and encourage him to pursue what is good, true, and beautiful? The habit of slapping letters or numbers on our students' work does not even come close to accomplishing this. In fact, I would argue that doing it actually fights against what we are aiming to do, in that our students are unintentionally moved to adopt a pragmatic ethic where anything is permissible in their minds as long as an A stands at the end of their journey. This year, I ran into a student who actually said, this is his motto, anything for an A. Right? That's not our goal. That's not our goal. And even if we say that letters and numbers really only assess student performance, right? Only their performance, not them as people, okay? They penetrate into our students' identities. They slowly begin to define who they are. So how does oral assessment deal with these problems? So if the purpose of classical education is to cultivate virtue and reorder loves, and if we really want to achieve these ends, then our students first, this is important, it's so simple, must trust us, right, on a personal level. We must have a mentor-apprentice relationship with them. The relational link between them and us must be personal presence. It must be a being with type of relationship, not the letter or the number. And oral assessment itself, and this is the beauty of oral assessment, is a context for doing just that, for building trust. When we employ oral assessments, when we sit down face to face with our students, when we talk to them, when we listen to them, when we help them, when we guide them, when we correct them, when we listen to them, they know we care. And if they know we care, then they can trust us. And if they trust us, right, then they will be willing to open their hearts to receive truth that will be transformative. Okay. You may be wondering how trust is earned. That was one of the questions I asked when I was like, how do you earn trust, right, with your students? You're their teacher. However, the simple answer is that in the format of oral assessment, it just naturally grows. It's really interesting. It just naturally grows. It's so simple. It almost does it for us. So whereas in written exams, they don't even have the essential ingredients to do that, right? If it's a formal written exam where they're sitting down, taking a multiple choice test, or even writing an essay in response, if that is the assessment, if that's the pinnacle of their assessment, it doesn't even have the ingredients for it. The people aren't there. So two, oral assessment also produces a context in which the right exam questions can be asked. Questions that can only grow out of a face-to-face embodied encounter with a student. Since oral assessment permits this, since we can sit face-to-face with our students, since we can hear them and listen to them, and we can construct the environment, we can actually discern the state that they're in. Right? We can actually discern the state that they're in. And ask questions that have the ability to reach beyond that of pre-written questions. Okay. And so pre-written questions, right? Questions that we write, pass out on a piece of paper, that they answer, okay, are by nature limited in scope, in ability, and in effect. So they are limited in scope because even a really well-written question can only assess two items, in my opinion, and that's retention and comprehension of ideas. That's all it can really do. It's limited in ability because it's limited in ability because there are no other questions or comments following them, right? Right? You ask one question and maybe a series of questions that lead, but if a moment of opportunity arises when the student is dealing with those, there's no one there to ask another question that may take them where they need to go. And then in effect, because even a really well-written question cannot match the power of a question that comes from the mouth of a mentor who cares and can be trusted. It's so simple, but it can't. And so indeed, I think that pre-written questions, they just can't get to the core of our students. They can't reach it like we can. And if they somehow do, like if that did happen, I don't think they have the capacity to keep commenting or asking questions that will actually nurture the students. Right? They're inert entities. So when the relational link, so actually point three now, so point three, when the relational link between teacher and student is letter or number, especially in the context of what students perceive as most important. So what do our students perceive as most important in our classrooms? What do you think? What are they always wondering about? What's going to be on the test? When's the exam? What's that, right? So especially in the context of what students perceive as most important, namely exams, it is nearly impossible to establish a mentor-apprentice relationship with students. When letters or numbers are the link, are the connection between teacher and student. Our students enter into an intimate, identity-shaping relationship with an impersonal, inert thing, right? And what happens is that they actually push their relationship with us to the side as less important. In this scenario, which is common, we are actually reduced to fact vending machines. Okay. That dispense nuggets of knowledge that our students take elsewhere to contemplate alone. That's what we become in this scenario. And in all practicality, the grade is our student's mentor, not us. The grade is leading our students. And oral assessment, on the other hand, imposes a mentor-apprentice relationship on both teacher and student. And the beautiful thing is that it shifts the agent of mentorship from the grade to the educator. Okay, so point four. So now it is possible to still use letters and numbers in oral assessments, right? Indeed, that is our natural inclination. That's how I have done oral assessments, and that's how I think of them. But I'd like to offer an alternative. to that. And the alternative is face-to-face feedback. Face-to-face feedback. Pretty simple. Feedback that comes straight from our lips, which authentically interacts with our students' work and, by extension, with our students' whole person. Rather than responding to our students' work with a letter or number, even a short written note that addresses some of the ideas that they had, and then calling it quits, we should respond with pointed and relevant comments in a conversation, challenging and growing questions, proper and loving advice, deeper and more thoughtful responses that challenge the work of our students, and so on. And I think it is fair to say that this type of feedback can only take place in the context of an oral assessment. I mean, you can't do that on a piece of paper. And if you did, it would take forever if you did it for every single student. Right? Because time, and we have to be stewards of time, too. I mean, we never think of that, but time is one of the hardest things, right, to be a good steward of. And so, before moving on to a practical illustration, I'd like to argue one last point that oral assessment handles really, really well. It's kind of a pet peeve of mine, actually. It worries me. And so, Aristotle, the whole Stoic tradition, Augustine, Aquinas, and recently James K. Smith, all propose that to some degree humans are habitual creatures. Okay, that is, habits are formative. And not just in the body, but they're also formative of the soul. So if we apply this concept to our modern assessment methods, how do they form our students, both body and soul? What behavioral patterns do they teach our students to adopt? How do they teach our students to approach the world? Right? Since our students look at assessments as one of the most important and serious aspects of their education, what do our modern methods teach our students about the things that are important or serious? Okay. How do they approach these things? So if we are training them by habit to approach exams and tests, which to our students are one of the most important things in their lives, right? And we are teaching them to do it with the modern methods that we use. What is being spoken to them? What are we ingraining into them? So, if habits instruct the whole person, then the cold desk, the hard pencil, the flat piece of paper, the enforced silence, the required isolation, the mandated motionlessness, they all teach our students to deal with important and serious matters alone and individually. So how many parents were in here again? How hard is it for you to get your kids to talk to you about what's going on in the classroom? I think this plays a part of that. Right? They don't think about sharing the things that are important and serious because we're training them not to with others. So, in almost all other areas of life, we would encourage, right, our students to do the exact opposite of being alone and dealing with important serious matters alone and individually. Right? I mean, we can think of I think we could come up with a whole bunch of examples where that's the case. Right? So why do we use an assessment method that pushes our students away from a healthy habit of dealing with serious and important matters with people? Oral assessment rewrites this habit and encourages our students to do it the right way, I think, to handle important and serious matters with people rather than alone and by themselves. So, we're moving into the practical illustration, because the big elephant in the room is, how in the world do we do this? Right, that's the hard thing. How do we do this well? How do we do a good oral exam? There's so many complications. It'd just be pages of listing the complications of that. So, in the introductory story that I gave, I gave you a brief glimpse of a practical illustration of an oral exam that I think accomplishes the purpose of classical Christian education. And so I'll review that illustration really quick, and then what I'll try to do is show you how the inter elements and parts work together and accomplish, right, the goals that we kind of discuss, and how it better accomplishes the purpose of classical education. So in the illustration that I gave, I was an 18-year-old Muslim who grew up in Iran. I had recently moved to the U.S. with my family for college, and I had the Hadith almost completely memorized, and I was quite familiar with the Quran. After living in the States for a few years, I ran across a website that showed Muslims converting to Christianity because the resurrected Jesus Christ had appeared to them. And I was confused. So what did I do? I went and bought a Bible at the local Barnes & Noble, and then I decided to go read the Bible every morning at the Starbucks down the street. And at that Starbucks, a Christian student approached me and asked, "Are you enjoying what you're reading?" I said, "I'm confused." And then that student sat down and said, "Why?" And so for this exam in particular, my students had to become, my comp civ students had to become the Christian from this imagined scenario, right? They had to then continue that conversation with me for approximately 20 minutes. The conversation, again, centered on the person, the life, and the work of Jesus Christ, but it also could deal with anything that was touched on in the unit that we had just covered. Okay? And I was not assessing retention of information or the comprehension of ideas, but their ability to demonstrate virtue and the fruits of the Spirit in this imagined situation. Okay. So, I always choose cheesy names. Like, whenever you name something, it always sounds horrible, right? So, this I have called imaginary construction. It's horrible. I'll rename it someday. But because the student and I use our imaginations to construct this situation. Okay. This exam experience. And we imagined it so that we both could live in it. The difference between being outside and in comes in now. So that we could live in the experience. So notice that the object of the assessment is not retention of information or the comprehension of ideas. Rather, it is the demonstration of virtue and the fruits of the Spirit. But, and this is incredibly important, the mind has not been neglected. And I'll try to explain why. Because in order for a student to succeed in this situation, right, to demonstrate the virtues or the fruits of the Spirit, they must also know and comprehend ideas about the Quran, the Hadith, the Sunni tradition versus the Shia or the Sufi, right? They must understand and know the Islamic portrayal of Christ versus the Christian portrayal. They also must know Islamic customs. They also must even have an understanding of Islamic stances on gender, because I was a male. Right? So if the student was a female interacting with me, that would be a little bit different, given the stance that Islam has on men and women and how they relate to each other and their value and worth. Right? So all of those things had to be present. Right? So the mind and thinking was fully engaged in this scenario. Also notice that the exam's emphasis, however, leads and moves and aims the student's heart at virtue and the fruits of the Spirit rather than at the other ones, right? Rather than at retention of information and rather than at the comprehension of ideas. It moves them at learning how to be wise, learning how to be just in this scenario. And if our assessment teaches our students what is important, then that assessment is actually doing the right thing, teaching them that those virtues and those loves are important. And so at this point, I need to introduce the other half of the assessment, because so far I've only described the form of the oral assessment. I've only described how the students take the exam, but I've completely neglected to discuss where the student is told how he or she did. Okay. So with this format, with the imaginary construction, I have chosen to divide it into two separate meetings. Okay, two separate meetings. The first is what we just discussed, the form, the imaginative experience of the exam. And the second meeting is for feedback. And so in this second meeting that I have with all the students, I usually begin by highlighting the different ways the student demonstrated the virtues or the fruits of the Spirit in the imagined experience. Okay, in the imagined experience. For instance, I might say it was prudence of you to withhold that comment until later on in the discussion after you had displayed a breadth of knowledge in Islamic customs. Why? Because if you would have made it earlier without acquiring my respect, its power and impact would have been lessened. Okay. Did you do that accidentally or did you do that intentionally? Did you even think about that when you came into the conversation? Or why should you do that, intentionally or unintentionally? Right? Also, you did a great job of clothing yourself with the fruit of patience throughout our conversation. I intentionally used harsh language and made myself very combative. You did a really good job of not getting angry with me. Right? Would you have been able to do that in a real life scenario, though? Why? Be honest with me. So after walking through what the student did well, I then usually move into a phase where I ask questions aimed at revealing scenarios when the student did not demonstrate virtue or fruit of the Spirit well. An example of this would be, how did you demonstrate temperance when you called me an idiot for not believing in the reliability of the New Testament? Okay. No, I'm just kidding. That's not a good example. But this would be a better example. Is it just for you? Is it just for you to misrepresent Islam? Right? You incorrectly represented this view, right? You actually confused. The Shiites believe that God or Allah has an essence. The Sunnis don't. They believe he's absolute will. Okay? That's a misrepresentation. And why is that unjust? Why is that unjust? And it is during this phase of questioning that I also offer advice or correction, right, in that mentor apprentice concept or context. And I usually finish up the meeting by connecting it to real life. So how would you do if this was something you experienced out in the real world? Right? And where would you struggle? Could you do this? Why not? Why don't you care? Right? Bring it back. So notice how the relational link between teacher and student is not the letter, right? It's not the letter in this scenario, but real personal presence. Notice how this context is fertile ground for growing trust. It's very personal. You're spending time with a student, and notice how this context just organically gives rise to that mentor-apprentice relationship, which is the foundation for doing true classical Christian education. And lastly, I think this model is somewhat classical as well. So thank you all for coming. I hope you learned something or you took something away from it. So thank you very much. So we do have, I guess, 7 minutes, right? 7 minutes for a few questions. Yeah. The time element. Yeah, it actually takes a restructuring of my entire curriculum schedule for the whole year. What? What do you mean highlights? How do I do it? Okay, well, actually, at our school, we have tutorials built into our schedule, which means that we meet with our students privately and individually every 2 weeks. And so that actually allows for that to take place during those tutorials. But that also takes place at the institutional level with the administration building that into our... So that's one way that we do it. I don't know if that helps because that's something that we have at our school that not many other schools probably have. But yeah, go ahead.
I love the personal interaction part. Mm-hmm. When it gets to the end of the term, mm-hmm.
something. Right. Well, is anyone familiar with how John Hopkins does this? How John Hopkins University does this? Are you familiar with it? Yeah. They actually don't reveal their grades to their students. they do it for practical purposes, to work in this world. But they, during the educational process, they don't really know what's going on. The way that they move forward or move back or learn is that the teacher says you're ready or you're not ready. So I know that, I mean, the answer to your question is we're not even really at a place to do what I've spoken on, but I'd like to spoken on, but we are at a place where we can begin trying to do that, whatever that may look like. Some good resources for administrators on rethinking that structure is on the CIRCE Institute's webpage, and I think that Chris Perrin talks about what that would look like overall. So, yeah. Right. Yeah, so I don't think you do necessarily. Yeah. So one thing I'm not saying is that, so I'm not saying to get rid of those types of things. What I'm trying to argue, I guess, is that the most significant assessment should not be aimed at that, if that makes sense. And so with sixth grade, I think that this would work. It also depends on the size of your school, what type of curriculum you use through the grammar school. What I've noticed is it works. It starts working better as you get up in the grades, though. So this worked really well for my 11th grade class. I also teach 7th graders. So the 7th grade format looks a little bit different than the one that I just presented to you. So I don't know if that helps or not. But correct. No, I think there are places, but I would. But there needs to be something above that, an ordering of those two activities, correct? An ordering of the importance. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Well, I teach at the Ambrose School. We still use grades, right? So, like, it's... I still slap a grade onto it. I'd like to get out of that, but we still do that. But with the oral examinations, I can tell a brief story with my 7th graders. So early on this year, I required my 7th graders to spend 2 hours conversing with their parents in preparation for an oral exam. And so when I gave the oral exam, I would ask the students, how much time did you actually spend with your parents preparing for this? And one of the students said, well, 6 hours in the last 3 days. I'm like, what? That's incredible, right? And the more beautiful thing is that that habit actually progressed and continued through the whole year. And he did that with his dad for the whole year. And in that scenario, his dad simply knew that he had the information, which was interesting. And, of course, this also invites the conversation to sit down and say, this is what I've observed of your son or daughter. It requires messy conversations, ones that are very hard with parents because they do want a statistical documentation. Here you go. They want it to be quantified. With my 7th graders this year, we had 3 oral exams. And with the 11th grade class that I taught, we actually had like 6 or 7. And that class actually only met 2 days a week. So, yeah. Mm-hmm. Actually, by doing it. I know that sounds like such a simple answer, but I took a survey. And actually, one of my seventh graders is in here right now, but I won't point him out. He is actually in here. But I took surveys at the beginning or throughout the year, and I asked, okay, what is your initial emotional kind of vomit when I say you're going to take a written exam, standardized multiple choice, versus you're going to have an oral exam with me where we're going to enter into Odysseus's homecoming and we're going to live as an additional character and do these things. What's interesting is that all of them said they get excited and a little bit scared for the oral exam because they have to talk to me face to face, but they're also excited. Their response to the other exam is usually, ugh. And so my advice would be to do it and actually watch what happens in that personal context. I don't know, does that help at all? Yes, there are. I mean, this is just one example. One of the things that I like is the process of imitation, where, let's say, so in fifth grade, what do you cover in fifth grade? Revolutionary War. Okay, so perhaps you could take whoever you'd want to from either side of that battle, and then the student would become that person and have to know the psychology of it. You can actually get up and they could debate in front of the class. Or do it that way, and that way it's a little bit more interactive. You could actually have a group discussion where you have a council of generals from, so you have a council of generals from the British or something like that. They sit around and they're discussing an idea. One of the ones that I had for the seventh graders is they had to become members of the Spartan Drusia, their council of elders, and they had to discuss whether or not they were going to attack. Basically, whether or not they were going to attack Athens. And they had to focus on these particular things, and I was watching how well they would impersonate or embody what they had learned. So that's another one, I guess, to do. Yes? Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Certainly. So for one of the oral exams that I gave for the Comp Civ class, which is actually a pretty big class, it's 35 kids. It's split into two sections though, so I have about 16 at one time, and I would divide them into usually four groups of four, and they would all do the same thing, but they would come up with it. So one of the exams that they did is we had just read through Buddhism, and we had read about the four signs that the divinities gave Buddha or Siddhartha as he left the temple. And so what they did is they had to redeem that for Christianity and create an experience leading someone to the Trinitarian God. And they had to do this in a scenario where they were at the mall and they all acted it out. And so they did that with those four people. Yeah. Yeah. That's where, I mean, depending on the assignment, the So I think so. At our school, the articulation, that would probably fall into the rhetoric classes that we have in 10th grade, where they're actually looking at pronunciation, clarity. But I don't necessarily bring that into the assessment. I look at how well they demonstrate the virtues in those contexts. So I don't know if that helps, but that's usually not a huge factor in the discussion. Usually a student knows that as well, and it's something that you can help them work on. I don't know if that makes sense, but. I actually ran into that this year. So in the Sparta Athens example that I gave, some of the students were very inclined to talk, and some of them were not. And so some groups were very quiet, and then some groups were absolutely phenomenal. And afterwards, I actually met with those students who were quiet individually and kind of said, okay, so what did you enjoy the experience? No, I'm an introvert. I didn't like getting up and talking about that. Well, why not? And they're, well, I just don't speak very well. And we just kind of walk through, and I try to help them see that this experience is less about them and more about what they're doing. And it kind of help them walk through that and see whether or not they are then willing to give the effort into working on that. So, yeah. Yes. So I told that to them, and they had it written out in front of them. So they took it home and they had it. They were fully prepared. However, they didn't know where the conversation would go. And that was a way that forced them to have the knowledge retained and to comprehend ideas, because it could go anywhere in the conversation. So,
is that it?
Thank you.
Oh, no.
Thank you. It's a conference. I've been late a few times, too. So.
sorry. That's all that I need. I'll put it in.
Would you like to use this?
I'm happy to do that.
Oh, someone real close.